I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Janet Groth had big dreams in 1957 after graduating from college and moving from the Midwest to New York City. She landed an interview with The New Yorker and was hoping to start her career as a writer. After that interview with the famous and painfully shy E.B. White, she was hired as a receptionist, a job she held for 21 years. Janet Groth writes about her time at the magazine, the creative and eccentric people who worked there, her love affairs and broken heart, and the cultural and personal barriers that held her back in a new memoir called The Receptionist. She went on to work as a professor and wrote several books before this one. And Janet Groth joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York City. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I'd love to begin actually where your book begins, which is your interview with E.B. White.
E.B. White was then one of the best-known writers on the magazine, but his shyness, I found out later, was of mythic proportions, and this interview was quite unprecedented. He seemed pained to be in the presence of anyone at all, much less a corn-fed girl from Iowa who was looking for a job. "What sort of work do you envision doing, Miss Groth?" His handsome, fine-featured gray head was lowered, his eyes cast down, his voice little above a whisper. I was overwhelmed with a desire to put this poor man at ease. "Well, I want eventually to write, of course, but I would be glad to do anything in the publishing field." Mr. White took a moment to absorb this information. When he could bring himself to speak again, he asked, "Can you type?" "Not at a professional level," I said. He coughed and looked at the resume that Arthur Ziegart had given him and that had led to my being there in his office. "What about this short story prize you won, this Anna Augusta von Helmholtz-Phelan prize?" he said. "Was that story typed?" I told him that yes, of course it had been, but that I deliberately maintained a slow, self-devised system that involved looking at the keyboard. I was afraid, you see, that if I became a skilled typist, I would wind up in an office typing pool. For the first time, Mr. White looked directly at me. "And you don't want to wind up there?" he asked. I suspected that he had some sympathy for the course I had taken. "No, I think anything would be more interesting to me than that," I said. How rash and how fateful that course turned out to be. After a few more questions, Mr. White concluded the interview by calling into his office Miss Daisy Terry. I later found out that she was a formidable figure around the magazine, its manager in charge of secretarial personnel. A petite woman of 4'9" or 4'10", no more than 5 feet, even an inch and a half heels, she had a cap of tightly curled white hair and a slash of geranium pink lipstick in a face dominated by piercing blue eyes. At perhaps 60 or so, she needed no glasses. Handing her my resume, White said, "Miss Groth is looking for a job here at the magazine, but would rather not be in the typing pool. Will you see if there's anything you can do for her?" "I will," she said, asking me to come with her.
And that's Janet Groth reading from the very beginning of her book called The Receptionist. And this was an interview that E.B. White did with her as she came looking for a job. He seemed determined to somehow put you into this typing pool, or at least get you behind a typewriter.
Well, he knew the drill, although he had never before, as I found out later, consented to see anyone in this capacity, and I don't believe he did ever again. Nevertheless, the idea of an entry-level position for a woman at that time at the magazine would have had to center on the typing pool.
And how much contact did you have with E.B. White after that interview?
Really very little, very intermittently. He would come down to the 18th floor where my desk was, his own office being on 19, and there was a kind of routine that he followed when he was in the city that took him from the elevator straight to his quarters, his sort of den.
His den. And mm-hmm. And when you were offered this job as receptionist at the New Yorker, did that feel like a come down?
Oh, well, no, I was thrilled to be in the halls of this magazine that I had only riffled through at the drugstore on the campus of the University of Minnesota, being unable to afford a subscription.
And the idea that you could work your way up the ladder at the New Yorker.
Well, yes, there was some sense in my getting there that I thought, oh, yes, one day my fiction will be there. I was thinking of myself as a fiction writer, you see. That short story contest that won the prize and so on.
Thinking that would open some doors for you. You did spend about a half a year at the art department at the New Yorker.
I did. After I'd been on the 18th floor, for about a year and a half, I was promoted to the assistant to the assistant of the art director upon 20, and I spent about 6 months with the cartoon editor, who was called the art director, and the cartoonists, who were called artists, and I enjoyed that very much, but I was not a particularly good fit with the art director. He was always Mr. Garrity to me, and I was much too Minnesota nice for him.
Oh, interesting. But part of your job was to send back rejected cartoons. I would think that's a tough job.
Well, I didn't like the idea of disappointing all those hopefuls week after week. And in fact, it was the sort of job that Truman Capote had had when he was there years before and failed to do. He simply shoved the rejected cartoons behind the desks, and they poured out many years later when the desks were moved.
Really? My mouth is open, and you can't see that on the radio.
Yes, it was a legend around the office.
Would you put a little note? I mean, would you try to sort of personalize these rejections?
Well, one would have liked to, but there was a very small printed rejection slip with the logo of the New Yorker, the Eustace Tilly on the top, and it simply said, sorry, this did not seem to be for us, the editors.
So you spent about 21 years as a receptionist on the 18th floor.
Yes, I like to think of it as the longest lateral career in journalistic history.
Because you stayed there for 21 years.
Perhaps like staying at a party too long.
Oh, did it feel like that?
Well, it was very, actually, it was very much my own decision to leave. I was not encouraged at any time to go, but I was encouraged to continue my PhD, which I was working on.
In fact, you got that while you were working there. You do
yes.
talk about my writers, my artists. I mean, you seem to have a very sort of personal, almost motherly feel about these people that worked at The New Yorker.
Yes, they were family to me. That's true. I really did feel that way, and they returned the kindness, so I liked that.
Quoting here, they wanted mothering, nurturing, providing a discreet and loyal personification of continuity on the writer's floor. Did you feel like that was your job?
Yes, and when I made tentative stabs at getting other jobs, I would like to have been a first reader of fiction, for example, that simply was not on, and I had to come to the conclusion that that was the one spot that they wanted me in.
So what does a receptionist on the 18th floor working at the New Yorker in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, what was your job? What did you do?
so minimal. So minimal. I hate to tell you, but I was at a desk on a floor where nobody actually came and went, so there was nobody to receive much. After I was unceremoniously sent back down to the reception desk after I came back from a trip to Europe and found that the art director had found his favorite former assistant back in her job. I discovered that the 18th floor had expanded, and it was now a bustling place with 40 writers or more. And what I did for them was keep track of them for the editors, basically. If they were in their offices, I was not expected to do anything more than say so when an editor asked. And they were not in their offices, I took messages for them.
And I'm sure taking messages for people, you learn about a little bit about their private lives.
Yes. One did learn. For example, I was startled to hear Leonard Bernstein's familiar voice. Actually, he liked to be called Bernstein, I think. And he said, "This is Lenny, and tell my brother Bert I love him." That was his message, invariably.
How nice is that?
there were lots of famous voices on the other end. Jacqueline Onassis would call a couple of people, George Tro and other people on the floor. And Charles Adams had a lovely lot of women, Mrs. Drew Hines III, and Joan Fontaine. I don't know if people remember her as the first Jane Eyre in a black and white. Maybe she wasn't the first, but she was certainly a memorable Jane Eyre.
And what was her message for Charles Adams? Whose cartoons I adored and
yes,
still adore.
They're wonderful. And he was very droll. He knew that he had a persona to keep up. And all her messages were, please tell him to call Miss Fontaine.
Ooh.
But when he came in and informed me that he had been missing for a while because he'd been on jury duty, I said, "Well, what sort of case did you have?" He said, "A murder case," with a glint in his eye. And I said, "Well, what was the verdict?" "Guilty," says he with great glee, and goes back to his office where he keeps an electric chair in the corner.
You mean that?
I mean that.
An antique
electric chair, yes.
You also house sat for Calvin Trillin.
Oh, I did, and that was a great pleasure. Alice Trillin became a friend, and the two little girls, they were little at that time, Sarah and Abigail, came up to my apartment at one point to bake Christmas cookies. Oh. Alice thought they ought to have some exposure to Christmas, even though they were a Jewish household. And we did the same thing at Easter time, dyeing Easter eggs. That was fun. When I was at the Trillin household, there was always a lot of very nice stuff in the freezer, including perfectly wonderful bagels.
Oh, how good is that? You had mentioned your trips to Europe, and we're almost up in a break here, but I have to say, you had a very generous vacation package where it sounds like you took a month or two off, paid for half of that time, and would often spend weeks in Europe.
Yes, all those editors and writers were away themselves, and some intern was forwarding their mail, so I could go as long as I could afford to.
And you went all over Europe?
I did. Well, the Eurail Pass was in full force then, and I made full use of it. Yes, eight times.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Janet Groth today on Radio Time. She spent 21 years as a receptionist at The New Yorker, got the job in 1957, and she's written a book called simply The Receptionist, An Education at The New Yorker. She has taught at a number of universities, written other books as well, and joins us on Radio Times. Any questions or comments you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Man is honored to welcome the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra with their music director, Manfred Honeck, Tuesday, July 24th. The internationally acclaimed conductor will lead the orchestra, along with featured cello soloist Johannes Moser, through an evening of Dvorak's Cello Concerto in B minor and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5 in E minor. Tickets are available at mancenter.org or 215-893-1999. The Man supports WHYY.
For her new album, singer Kelly Hogan solicited songs from friends like Robin Hitchcock, Vic Chestnut, and M. Ward.
I feel like the Johnny Appleseed of these songs, so it enables me to go door to door and spread the great songs around.
Kelly Hogan shares some of those great songs live in our studio, this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Recovering from a health crisis might be something you'd like to keep private, but Grammy Award-winning singer Regina Bell says her story could inspire fans.
I'm not scared to talk about it now, because this is huge. I'm a walking miracle.
The incomparable Regina Bell takes fans higher with her new gospel album. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Janet Groth. She was a receptionist at The New Yorker for 21 years, has gone on to earn a PhD in English. She's professor emeritus of English at Plattsburgh State University of New York, also teaches at Columbia University School of Continuing Education in the summer session. She's written several books, including a memoir called The Receptionist, an Education at The New Yorker, and joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. As I was reading your book, I was thinking about Mad Men, which, of course, is about the advertising industry. Around the same time that you were at The New Yorker, Mad Men is all about smoking and drinking and having affairs at the office. Is there a New Yorker version of Mad Men?
Oh, I think very much so. We were not unlike that office, except in its glitz and in its glamour. Outwardly, The New Yorker played down its reputation for sophistication and rather gloried in linoleum floors and gray walls and filing cabinets instead of all that chrome and glass.
You describe having lunch friends, Berryman, Mitchell, others that you would have a regular lunch session with.
What a privilege to have literary
Absolutely.
Discussions with men of that caliber. I was very, very lucky that way.
And what did you talk about?
Well, with Joseph Mitchell, I tell that our conversation very often was about death. We talked about books, of course, but our luncheons began when one night at Costello's, after a number of New Yorker people had gone there after an Ed Koren gallery show. Ed Koren, the cartoonist of the furry animals.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, we wound up at Costello's, and I, for some reason or other, quoted Lily, the coat room girl in Joyce's The Dead. Men is nowadays only all palaver and what they can get out of you. And Joseph Mitchell, who loved Joyce, was a member of the James Joyce Society, turned his attention to me, and thereafter we worked up quite a Joyce discussion at lunches every Friday, and we went on to other topics. But as I say, it was often about death, the death of some restaurant, some part of New York, some idea of the passing of the scene of his father's cotton and tobacco farm, and of the Fulton Fish Market, which got its death knell while we were lunching together.
Interesting. John Berryman was another person that you had lunch with. He was a professor at your college, and talked to you about marriage. He sounds like he was interested in marrying you.
For a time, I was one of a long list, I later discovered, of women to whom he was proposing marriage. In fact, I tell about having gone to a kind of a women's discussion group in New York, and this must have been in the 60s, and Berryman's name came up when men and their difficulty with commitment were mentioned, and he was cited as a case of overcorrection.
Oh dear! So you were not alone in that one.
No, of the seven members of the discussion group, he'd proposed to three of us, and I like to say that was only in New York.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Well, there is someone else in your book. You don't name him, but you call him Evan Sim, the Great Deceiver. And I'm wondering whether people who worked with you at The New Yorker or know The New Yorker whether they have been able to figure out who this person was.
Well, Mary Norris, who wrote a wonderful blog on The New Yorker website about the book launch party that was conducted down at the National Arts Club, mm-hmm. early in June, and it reminded her that she had been at the magazine perhaps 3 months from Academe while I was heading out to Academe, and so we passed in the night. But her suggestion was that the bad boy involved, that I call Evan Sim, was actually Frank Modell, but that had to be corrected. He wasn't the one. He probably would have liked that reputation, because I think he well, we won't say he deserved it. He's certainly not a cad, as Evan Sim most certainly was. But he was he liked the ladies.
Well, as you describe, and this is—I mean, I have to say—it was sad, in fact, to read about that he wooed you, seduced you. I think is some of the words that you used. You went to Lancaster County on a long trip, and it seemed that he was the one. And then you find out that he was actually engaged to another woman.
Yes, in a very shocking way, he had taken me down to look at an apartment, which I thought we were going to move into as newlyweds, and it was on Washington Square. I remember it very vividly. The landlady said, "Well, it's so nice of you to come down on your lunch hour, Miss Groth, to give Mr. Sim your women's point of view. When was it, Mr. Sim, you said that your fiancé was due to come over from Austria? Was it December? I'm afraid I can't hold it that long without a deposit."
Wow, and you had no idea?
No idea. So somehow or other, I got back to the office, but it was the beginning of a very difficult time. And I suppose we might as well warn the reader: there is an episode of a suicide attempt, yeah, and a brief stay in Bellevue, and all kinds of fairly dramatic events.
Well, in fact, I'm open to the page where you write about that, and not to belabor it, but you tried to kill yourself using, I guess, the gas from your stove.
That's right. It was a case of my life having been saved by a misunderstanding. I thought when there was an aluminum plate on the front door of my apartment that said it was a fire door, that meant that it was airtight. And so I didn't have any rugs to stuff under, although I had seen people who were about to do this in movies put rugs under the door. I didn't have any rugs. It was a bare-floored apartment. So one way or the other, the gas seeped out, and thank goodness some people who lived downstairs and I thought were away came back. Wow. Early and broke in, and the fire department came with an ambulance and a medic, and off I went to Bellevue.
Yeah, clearly a very difficult time for you. But you also write here, and I'm looking at this couple of sentences. This is about Evan Sim, as you call him. "I thought he was funny looking, jug-jawed and knobby-nosed and ungraceful in stride. How in the world, if not attracted to him, did it happen that I thrilled to his touch? Quite surprisingly, these were questions I did not ask. I did, however, begin keeping notebooks." So it sounds that you hadn't kind of thought through this relationship.
Well, you know the term analyst comes from alienist, and the idea is that people can be alienated from their own feelings, and I was certainly a classic candidate for analysis. And ironically enough, one of the things that happened as a result of my diagnosed passive dependency, mm-hmm, was that the New Yorker, whose insurance covered shrinks as if it were, you know, one of their main things, because writers routinely needed them, and 80% of the psychoanalysis that I underwent was covered by the insurance at the magazine. So they paid handsomely to rid me of this.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. Janet Groth is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the 21 years that she spent at The New Yorker. The book is called The Receptionist, an Education at The New Yorker. And Janet Groth joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You do write about going to this therapist. He seemed like he was extremely helpful for you. As you said, your head needed some shrinking.
Yes, indeed. And I was very lucky there. He was a wonderful man. He died much too young of colon cancer, but he was Daniel Kaplowitz, and a great psychoanalyst.
So what did he help you understand about yourself?
Oh, he said that, for example, when I had been taking a course here and there toward the master's degree down at New York University, and was talking about finding the classroom experience when I once went out to Queens Community College and taught a course and loved it. I discovered that I'd need a PhD in order to do that at the college level. And I said, do you think I can get a doctorate? And he said, well, isn't it about time you did something that was good for you?
Oh, wow.
And then he said, yeah, I know it's the dissertation that's you're making you so fearful, and whether you can write it or not. And then he suggested that it wouldn't be being a good sport not to try.
Well, as you said, I don't necessarily like diagnoses, but as you mentioned, he described you as having a kind of passive dependency. Does that make sense to you as you look at your life?
Oh,
then?
Absolutely. I'm not sure that it's actually made it into that book that psychiatrists
the DSM,
used.
Right?
But it was a very accurate description of the what Oprah much later would refer to routinely as low self-esteem that holds so many women back, and certainly was doing that for me. But he was good about jacking me up, and he understood that my self-esteem could be won in terms of my own self-regard by earning the PhD, which indeed it did.
You write a little bit about growing up in the Midwest, grew up the home of Spam. Did I get that right?
Well, I went to high school in Austin, Minnesota, which indeed is the town that George A. Hormel had his main plant in, and their main product was Spam, yes,
wow.
And now they have a big Spam museum there.
And you talk a little bit about your parents and their marriage and some of the troubles in the family as well.
Yes, my father was an alcoholic, and I think that the smaller town down in northern Iowa where I was born and spent my first formative years had a great deal to do with that sense that I absorbed, that the townspeople, we may have had one of the biggest houses in town and owned the biggest grocery store, and my father was a successful merchant until that building burnt down. But not very tolerant behavior about the drunkard, the town drunkard, and oh, too bad that Esther, that's my mother, has to work in the store to keep an eye on him and has to leave the children at home.
So he was known as the town drunkard?
I'm afraid so, and a kind of a stain on our reputation that I carried with me as if it were mine, you know.
Well, as you say, you described yourself as daddy's girl, and what daughter doesn't want to be daddy's girl?
Yes, there was a lot of conflict there.
Yeah.
The good daddy and the bad daddy and so on.
And you also say you didn't know how to be honest with men.
Yes, you've read that carefully.
I did read
Marty.
It. I read it very carefully.
That was a moment of truth that I place in a trip to Greece, which I thought was an appropriate place to examine one's life, and I certainly had been putting that off, partly through my explorations of my feelings with Dr. Kaplowitz, which actually followed that soul-searching trip to Greece, I discovered that there was a lot in my misery with men that I was accountable for. And one of them certainly was this idea that, like my mother, I had a flirtatious and seductive manner with men that I would then ignore when passes were made at me. I'd be outraged. How dare you? Oh, yes, lots of dishonesty there.
Well, and I think many people can relate to that. But you also sound as if you were a very attractive woman. You had, as you describe, ponytail. I think you give us your measurements, 36, 26, 36.
Yes.
So you must have been quite a looker.
I had the privilege of seeing some of those old pictures, some of the more flattering ones, in the New York Times Styles section on June 28th when they did run those pictures, the one with the 12-inch ponytail and so on.
Well, you did find love and marriage, it sounds like. You married a man named Alizar.
I did, and it was just a very lucky turn of events for me. I think it's one of the only happy landlord-tenant relationships on record. He was my landlord down in the village, and for years he was doing a quiet courtship of me, and it was so subtle I didn't realize it. So it took him a while to actually take me out, but we became very close, and he was wonderful, wonderful husband and lover.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Was it hard for you to leave The New Yorker when you did?
No, it was certainly high time, and I had all the plans in place for my move onward and upward into academe. I was what is called an all but dissertation, ABD at NYU, and I had a job at the University of Cincinnati as an assistant professor on the tenure track, and I was quite ready to go. There was a nice little ceremony, and Mr. Sean, the editor-in-chief, came down from his offices, which he never did, and someone handed him a single red rose to hand to me, and off I went. End of an era.
And the end of an era. And anything that you miss about that 18th floor?
Oh, well, the people, of course. And one of the great pleasures of this memoir was that many of these people are dead now, and I was able to relive and remember so vividly what they were like and to miss them all over again.
Well, you say about Muriel Spark, she was your fairy godmother.
Yes, she went so far as to send me to a county ball in England. I was her private secretary. She got invited to the ball. She was not going to be in England, but I was going to be there, going to Oxford that summer. She said, "Would you like to go?" And I said, "Oh, I'd be delighted." Next thing I knew, we were sending off for tickets for me and three of my friends, an escort, and some wonderful friends from England named Peter and Winifred Rowe. Off we went to Sussex.
Well, sounds like Cinderella's story, doesn't it?
Yes, it was.
You opened and answered her mail.
I did, yes, and she got a lot of mail from people she called her priestlings. As a Catholic convert, she was much admired, and young men studying for the priesthood felt that it would be wonderful if she would just come to their ordinations, and I was in charge of saying, no, I'm sorry, Mrs. Spark will not be able to attend.
More rejection letters, right?
Ah, there we go.
So I'm assuming you read The New Yorker?
Always, yes.
Always. and look for, I don't know, a young unnamed writer who appears in The New Yorker? Or a new writer?
Do you mean with my name on it?
Well, I don't know about your name, but maybe someone who you'd never heard before, and there they are in The New Yorker.
Ah, yes. I wish I could be absolutely sure I've got it right, but a story by someone, I think it was George Sanders, just knocked me out really last year. It was just a wonderful story about a returning Vietnam vet, I think it was. Wonderful story.
Janet Groth, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. The book is called The Receptionist, An Education at The New Yorker. Coming up next, we'll be talking about what's been going on in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Announcing the 2012 WHYY Connections Festival, September 6th through 9th. 4 days of free arts and culture events, including an outdoor concert featuring Yola Tango, Frank Turner, Maps and Atlases, and more, Saturday, September 8th. And on September 9th, performances by Fred Paris and the Five Satins, Charlie Gracie, and more at the Philadelphia Doo-Wop Festival. More artists and events to come. Visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Aaron Sorkin, creator and writer of the new HBO series The Newsroom, a backstage drama about a cable news show. Like Sorkin's other shows and movies, The West Wing, The Social Network, and A Few Good Men, there are plenty of verbal fireworks. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. If you've ever had a migraine, you know how incapacitating they are. The characteristic throbbing and pulsing in the head, the stomach upset, and sensitivity to light, to sound, and even smell. Sufferers have two choices: prescription drug treatment or behavioral approaches. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, we'll discuss headaches, their crippling effects, and the latest on treatment. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last week, Scranton Mayor Christopher Daugherty reduced the salaries for city workers to minimum wage. That's $7.25 an hour for the 400 police officers, firefighters, clerical, and DPW workers who work for Scranton, a city of about 75,000. The mayor said the city is running out of money. Others say the relationship between the mayor's office and city council is part of the problem. We asked Boris Krawchenyuk to join us. He's politics reporter for the Times Tribune of Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, writes the Random Notes column under the pseudonym Roderick Random. And Boris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And any questions from our Scranton area listeners? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. So, Boris, was this a surprise when the mayor made this decision?
When the mayor made the decision, yes, it was, yeah.
No one saw it coming?
Well, we knew that there was some kind of crisis approaching, but the fact that the mayor was going to cut out, that we thought it would be payless paydays, that was the talk all along, and the mayor decided to do something a little bit different.
And the mayor has the authority to do that?
I don't think so. I think the courts have said no, and the unions are taking him to court to uphold the previous judicial ruling that said that he didn't have the authority. They're looking to go. Actually, I think that it's postponed a week. They're looking to have the court find him in contempt.
Now, some of the reporting that you've been doing that I read is that something for the city council, or I guess the government of Scranton, has to pay about $1 million every 2 weeks to cover the salaries for
these. $1.2 million.
$1.2 million. So cutting it back to $7.50 an hour, how much money do they save?
I don't know if I've done that calculation. It's probably about a third, a half to a third of what they would normally pay.
So, looking at, let's say, a police officer or a firefighter, what was their salary typically speaking?
$15 to $25, depending on. I think that's right.
$15 to $25 an hour.
Yeah, depending on what year they were and how much experience that kind of.
So that would be what, about a $40,000, maybe $35,000 to $60,000, $70,000.
Well, let me actually, I can check that for you real quick. I think the salary for a first year firefighter was about $49,000, and for a first year cop it was about $55,000. Mm-hmm. I will check that for you real quick, but we can get back to that.
Okay.
So it's a substantial amount of money. You know, they're making good salaries for this area.
And
there it is. It's a first-year firefighter makes $49,000. First-year police officer makes $45,000. In their second year, they shoot up to $61,000 for firefighters and $56,000 for police.
Okay, fair enough. Part of the explanation, at least coming from the mayor, is that the city has, what, $5,000 in the bank? But then I read maybe that's not the correct number. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was today, what it is today, because we just haven't asked the question. But they, you know, regularly get revenues, and as of last week, they were at about $500,000, which is still well short of where they needed to be. And there was a bit of a dispute as to how much there was. City Council was saying 1.2. The business administrator was saying 500,000. It could just be coming down to a matter of timing when they actually check. Besides paying the payroll, the city still has other bills. You know, has to pay its health insurance, has to pay its for gasoline for its cars, and both of those creditors are asking for payments, regular payments. Blue Cross of Northeastern Pennsylvania was actually threatening to cut off health insurance if the city didn't start taking action to move forward on this, and I think they made a payment, somewhat of a payment, a couple of weeks ago.
So how does Scranton get in such trouble?
Well, we only have 15 minutes.
We do. Sorry about that, but go ahead.
Well, Scranton's been a distressed city for more than 20 years. They were one of the early entries into the state's Municipally Distressed Cities program. And over the years, there have been basically two mayors since then, Mayor Connors and Mayor Daugherty, Mayor Jim Connors and Mayor Chris Daugherty. And During the 90s, Pennsylvania Economy League, which was appointed by the state to oversee the city's financial recovery, accused Mayor Connors of not following the financial recovery plan that they came up with. At one point, the mayor handed out big salary increases to the police and firefighters in the late 90s without taking some of the other steps that were required to keep the budget balanced. State sanctioned the city, cut off the flow of all the state money in the late 90s, and the Mayor Daugherty came in. Those sanctions were still in place. He got them lifted by taking various steps to get them lifted and engaged a new recovery plan. And that actually went before the voters and was approved by the voters. He fought for a decade to make sure that that plan was enforced. Went all the way to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court found some language in the act that governs distressed municipalities that said that the language of the act could not supersede the language that unions bargain with, police and firefighter unions bargain with under state law. So that meant the city was on the hook for a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. It ended up about $15 million, and in addition to that, the raises that were part of the arbitrations were put into place, and that's how they end up getting paid what they get paid now. And so the city has to, you know, pay off a big back pay bill, plus it has to pay these new salaries. But that's all in addition to what's going on right now.
Well, I'm wondering about the recession, the mortgage crisis. I was reading that about a quarter of people living in Scranton are at the poverty level. So this is a city that also hit hard.
Right. The median income in the city is household income is only about $35,000. Oh. So the firefighters and the police are on the high end of the local pay scale.
Help us understand the relationship between the mayor and city council. And we should say that they're all Democrats, so it's not a partisan battle here. But what's at issue here?
The mayor, in the early part of his tenure, he's been there now since 2002, and he had a very friendly Democratic council. After a period of time, that changed, and the current council president took over the council. She, in the last an election or two ago, gained what's called a supermajority, four votes of the five votes on the council, and so she can basically veto anything that the mayor does. That council can override any veto the mayor imposes on any kind of legislation, which they did. In fact, in this current budget, they overrode his veto. They've overridden his veto of the last two council budgets, and that's kind of a big bone of contention here. But for whatever reason, and you know, it's a long history, they do not get along, and you'd like to think that it's all policy related, but sometimes it seems to get personal.
Right. And we're talking about Council President
Janet Evans and the mayor,
and Mayor Christopher Daugherty,
right?
And that it feels like they don't like each other.
They definitely don't like each other at this point. Although they're trying to get along and trying to get this new recovery plan done so that the city can go. Mm-hmm. Get money from the banks. That's essentially what has to happen right now. The banks are basically, the city needs to borrow money to get through the year, and because this budget was funded partially by a loan, and the banks have, because the city council balked at paying off a guarantee on a Scranton Parking Authority loan earlier this year, the banks ran away and then said, no, you got to get the recovery plan in place that shows us how you're going to pay this back if we give you the money. And so that's what they're working on right now, coming up with a recovery plan that will cover that the city can take to the banks and say, this is how we're going to pay you back. The mayor wants a big tax increase. The council wants a much smaller tax increase, and they're trying to work it out right now. They are actually talking.
Oh, I guess that's progress.
Yeah.
And that's Boris Krauchenyuk. He's a politics reporter for the Times Tribune of Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He writes the Random Notes column under the pseudonym Roderick. That's so funny. I don't know why that's so funny, but Roderick Random. And we asked him to join us to Radio Times today just to get us up to speed on what's been going on in Scranton and some of the financial problems that the city faces, and also what appears to be some personal grudges back and forth between the head of city council and the mayor. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Now, Boris, Mayor Daugherty has called for a 78% property tax increase over the next 3 years. What's the chance that he's going to get approval on that?
None. You know, the council basically said that's not going to happen, and since they have a majority of four of the five members, that won't happen. What will happen is some smaller increase, not sure what level it will be, probably half. I'm guessing that it'll be around half of that. You know, they're going to try to put other alternative revenue sources into place that create money, some financial help, a commuter tax, a parking tax on all the parking spaces in the city. They're looking to get a change in state law that would allow them to do a payroll tax. Part of the problem with any large municipality is it usually has a lot of nonprofits institutions. So when you have nonprofits, the property tax doesn't apply to them.
Right.
And so a large part of the city's tax base is untaxed because of all the nonprofits that are in the city. Problems that outer municipalities don't have. So in order to address that, they're trying to get a payroll tax. They want the mayor's looking for a sales tax. The council wants a payroll tax to hit the people who work at the nonprofits.
Well, I'm thinking about, as you said, the median salary or income in Scranton about $35,000 or so. Can people afford to pay if it's an additional fee or a parking tax? That's going to hit the people that live there pretty hard.
The parking tax might not, because a lot of that is people who live outside the city. And there's some debate about whether or not. The mayor's now trying to make the case because, you know, every day we're writing about 78% tax increases. He's making the case that the city's tax is actually a small portion of the overall tax bill, that the school district tax bill and the Lackawanna County tax bill are actually larger portions, and that the amount that the city's actually going to have, the average resident will pay, is about $130. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to check on that. So he's saying that basically $10 more a month for the average property owner. He has a re-election campaign next year, and I'm sure that he's keeping that in mind, you know, because 78% looks big.
It sure does. It sure does. But it also sounds like there are a fair number of, as we say, eds and meds up in the Scranton area, and they don't get hit by the property tax.
That's right. That's right. We have a new medical school that opened a couple of years ago. The next year is going to graduate its first class. We have two large universities and a whole bunch of other nonprofits downtown as well.
We called you up because we were reading about Scranton. Has Scranton become, and we should say the hometown of Vice President Joe Biden.
It is.
Do you find that there's increased press attention on what's been going on in Scranton?
Oh, there was a tremendous amount last week. I don't think it had anything to do with Biden's visit. It's suddenly that Twitter picked up on, you know, somebody saw it on Twitter, and the fact that the mayor is not paying, is cutting the salary to minimum wage.
Yeah.
Once that gets out there, that's so novel that everybody picked up on it. So in the last week and a half, we've had a whole lot of attention from all the national media.
Are other people tightening their belt? I mean, if the mayor's asking firefighters and police officers and clerical workers to work for minimum wage, have they
and
done...
And DPW workers,
And
yeah.
DPW workers as well. Asking, I mean, I don't know if they get paid, if that's a paid position or not, but are they cutting their belt or tightening their belts up there?
This affects, you mean in city government? Everybody
yes.
in city government is affected except for 40 people who are paid by federal funds.
Huh.
Because federal funds are, you know, basically pass-through funds, the people who work, and there's about 40 of the 440
mm-hmm.
people who work for the city who work are paid by federal funds. They're the only people who are unaffected by this. Supposedly the mayor and the city council are getting minimum wage as well.
They're getting paid $7.25 an hour as well.
Yeah. Although with the council, in the case of council, they're part-time anyways. I'm not sure how they're calculating
right.
that, but...
Now, as you have mentioned, the unions have sued over this minimum wage, saying it's a violation of their contract.
And they won. The judge agreed with them. And because the mayor went ahead and paid them at minimum wage anyway, they're now headed back to court to find the mayor, asking the judge to find the mayor in contempt of court, which could lead to the city being fined for failing to comply with the judge's order. The judge has... was on vacation last week and has delayed the hearing another week. My guess is that the judge is sensing that maybe this will all be resolved before he has to rule again. But I think if it ends up back in court, he's not going to have much choice but to find the city. in contempt.
And apparently, or reportedly, that the state has offered, some loans, some grants to help, push the mayor and council to come up with some kind of a plan?
A $2 million loan and a $250,000 grant if they come up with a plan. So the money won't flow until the plan is adopted, and that has to be done. The plan has to be written and in general agreement by August 1st and then officially adopted by August 15th. And basically what that would do is, once the plan is adopted, you're going to need time to go to the banks and convince them to give you money, and then run all that paperwork to sell the bonds and things like that. The state money would act as like a bridge to when the loan money comes through.
And is anyone talking bankruptcy?
We've talked about it, I think, in the paper more than the mayor and the council president have, although it's certainly lurking in the wings, that if things didn't change, that's what could happen. Don't think the mayor wants to do that. You get even more negative. You can see what happened with San Bernardino and Stockton, California, two cities that filed for bankruptcy, all the negative press that has come along with that. The mayor wants to avoid that, and I think the council does too.
Well, Boris, thanks so much for joining us, getting us up to speed on what's been going on in Scranton. Thanks so much.
Sure, anytime.
And that's Boris Krawchenyuk. He's politics reporter for the Times Tribune of Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, writes the Random Notes column, also writes a column under the pseudonym Roderick Random. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.